Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the Soundcheck Podcast. We're online at soundcheck.org. You're my wonder, little wonder, off across the sea. You're my wonder, little wonder, won't you wander back to me, back to me.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Bellingham, Washington's hometown heroes, Death Cab for Cutie, return this month with their eighth full-length record. It's called Kintsugi. It's a Death Cab record through and through, but much of the conversation about the band over the last few months has centered on the departure of a founding member, Chris Walla. Joining me here in the Soundcheck studio to talk about a brave new Death Cab era are the two other longest-serving members, Ben Gibbard, lead singer and multi-instrumentalist. Ben, welcome back.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And bassist Nick Harmer. Nick, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thanks for having me.
The new album, the new Death Cab for Cutie record, is called Kintsugi. What does that title mean?
It's actually a Japanese word to describe a technique of repairing broken ceramics. Actually, I think it literally in English translates to golden joinery, which...
Okay.
Is basically it's a technique of using 24 karat gold or any gold really infused into the resin or the glue to piece together back broken ceramics, porcelain, basically anything that you want to really repair.
So it's actually making an art out of repairing something that's broken.
Exactly. Yeah. It sort of comes out of a philosophy of making a repair to an object part of the new history of the object.
Now that's a really interesting title for a record that, you know, is basically Chris's last salvo with the band. Mm-hmm. You know, I think people are going to start putting two and two together here and maybe getting 22. Did you see this album as a repair of some sort?
You know, it's interesting. People have kind of been jumping to that conclusion that the title is meant to refer to that. And you know, I don't see it that way at all. For me, what really resonated about the title and what resonates about the title is that, you know, that technique is something that I've been trying to do with music my whole life. It's like when things are broken in my life and the lives of those around me, and, you know, you want to kind of create something out of that struggle, mm-hmm. of that strife, you know, what one is doing as a songwriter is ostensibly highlighting all those broken pieces and kind of trying to make something beautiful out of them. So I don't see the title as referring to Chris's departure at all. I see it more as a reflection of not only the songs on this record, but kind of a really nice encapsulation of what I've been trying to do for the last 20 years as a songwriter.
Yeah. Now, it's important to say that the new album, that Chris is on it. I mean, mm-hmm. he's all over it.
Oh, absolutely.
Doing his usual thing.
Yeah.
Just not producing it.
And, that's correct, yes.
And so what kind of a difference? You have Rich Costey?
Yes.
Who produced Decemberists. He did that Interpol record when they signed to the major label.
He did Muse. He did some Muse.
So, you know, how big a difference does a change in producer make for you guys? And then perhaps the more interesting question for us, the audience, mm-hmm. the listeners.
Well, for us, you know, I mean, it was something that, you know, and I mean this is no slight to Chris and his talents, but something that I think we all, you know, wished we would have maybe even done earlier. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, I think that we have been our world in, you know, in this band, is so unique in the sense that we've had somebody in the band producing the records over the years. And for the most part, I think that has had positive results. I don't say that because I'd want to go back and change anything.
Right.
But, you know, for me, it was a huge eye-opener as to kind of what a producer really does, you know. I mean, because I'd always seen Chris as my bandmate first and producer second. When Chris was producing records, these were songs that he was then going to go into the world and have to perform ad nauseum. But an outside producer, their only job is creating the best record out of the songs that exist in that time and place. There's no antiquity with the band. There's no, like, I got to play this guitar part for the next 2 years. You know, there's none of that. So, you know, Rich's perspective that he brought in really changed the direction of the album, because we had started working on this record in 2013 with Chris producing it. And after a couple weeks, he came to us and ostensibly fired himself and said, I don't think I'm the right person to work on this record. And I think that was the right decision for all of us.
Right.
And, you know, just hearing kind of what Rich brought to some of the songs that we had recorded, had attempted to record in the previous year, was a real eye-opener to me, that this is what somebody who's not in the band can bring to these songs. And that's, that, like I said, once again, to reiterate it, that's not a slight to Chris.
Right.
It's just that when somebody's outside of it, they can see things that somebody inside of it can't. And I think we desperately needed that.
Well, you know, I think of, like, you know, when David Bowie took up with Nile Rodgers, mm-hmm. you know, and everyone was like, wow, what a different sound. Mm-hmm. And it was. But then, you know, with after a few years go by, all right, you know, he worked with Eno, he worked with Tony Visconti, mm-hmm. he worked with Nile Rodgers. As the years go by and you have the benefit of hindsight, it's like, it's all Bowie.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's I listen to this new record and it's a Death Cab record. I mean, do you guys feel that way?
I do, definitely. I think that's honestly, that was one of the things that Rich was very concerned about along the process. I mean, he would constantly check in with us and with himself about, you know, he wanted to push us and challenge us in ways that we hadn't been pushed and challenged in years. But I think, you know, he was really good about stopping and asking, you know, is this still Death Cab? You know, are you guys comfortable in this? Are we making choices that you guys are excited about? And I mean, it wasn't even a conversation that we were having actively. I just know that, you know, he has.
Well, he would stop and say things like, yeah, it sounds great. Sounds like you guys.
Yeah, exactly. You know? Yeah. And I think, you know, he didn't want to rehash history, but I think that he was really, I mean, it speaks to his strengths as a producer. He knows what we're good at, and right. and he could zero in on the things that are in our comfort zones and in our wheelhouse, and then pull us into areas that maybe we were not seeing or reluctant to go to.
Okay, now I don't want to get too deeply into the weeds here on what a producer does on every record, but I do want to ask, when it comes to sequencing the record, whose decision is it to go, you know, No Room in Frame first, you know, Ingenue towards the end, you know, who makes those decisions?
Yeah, it's kind of a committee decision, but I do think that Rich kind of brought some interesting perspectives into album sequencing that I had not really thought of before. And one thing that he had said was, and, you know, I now believe this to be true, it's like the way a lot of people are listening to this record is that they're listening to it on streaming sites, they're listening to it on the internet. People don't have, you know, the attention span mm-hmm. for, like, let's put the 12-minute challenging track first and then go into the acoustic thing and then later have the hits track 8, 9, 10. He's like, front load the album, put all of the quote-unquote hits at the front of the record and just, like, you know,
but that's rock 101. People have been
it
doing
is,
that forever.
But it's strangely very different as to how we have always worked. I mean, it seems like as I go through our records, we always tend to have like a song opening that's kind of like a statement. You know, there's a piece in the middle that is kind of a larger kind of like, you know, meaty piece.
Slipping through the years. My old clothes don't fit like they once did. So they hang like ghosts of the people.
And kind of a slow build, and then, you know, like there's something kind of soft and quiet at the end. You know, I think that, and like I said before, these things have worked for us in the past, mm-hmm, so mm-hmm. I don't mean to kind of throw ourselves under the bus in how we sequenced albums, but I do think that Rich brought a perspective of, like, you know, a Rock 101 perspective that maybe we had kind of lost sight of, because we always think of, you know, people listening to the albums, you know, start to finish rather than the way people tend to do it now, which is kind of cherry pick stuff.
Well, you know, it does. The album does have a kind of reflective closer, but the song I wanted to ask you specifically about here and maybe listen to is the opening seconds of the record. You know, it begins mm-hmm. with this kind of spacey, looped electronic sound, mm-hmm. and you think, oh, what is this going to be? But very quickly, the guitars come in and you were clearly into... But, you know, was there a little bit of misdirection there, just those opening few seconds?
I think that that kind of little piece in the beginning was something that was very kind of... very Death Cab-y to kind of have something like that at the front. But I think as the song opens up and we get, you know, we get into like the feel, the kind of the role of the song, which is this kind of swing.
I don't know where to begin. There's too many things that I can't remember. As I disappeared like a trend and the hum of the five in the early morning. And now I'm taking my time.
We learned in the process of making, of recording that song, that's an incredibly difficult tempo and feel to pull off without having it sound like Everybody Wants to Rule the World by Tears for Fears, which is one of my favorite songs. If we were going through different arrangements of that song, we were like, we can either make this sound exactly like Everybody Wants to Rule the World, which is not necessarily a bad thing, but not in our wheelhouse. You know, how do we pull this back and make a little more Death Cab for Cutie, you know?
You cannot outrun a ghost, speeding southbound lanes with abandon. It catches you on the coast or on the cliffs of the Palisades. You killed the engine.
Little bit of the new album by Death Cab for Cutie called Kintsugi. It comes out on March 31st. Now, Ben, you've mentioned two things already. One is, you know, having a producer who doesn't have to go and play this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other is this song and, you know, the kind of challenge of making this a Death Cab song and not somebody else's.
Mm-hmm.
Both of which lead me to ask how this is going to work when you guys play live. Chris Walla did not produce the record, but he played on it.
Mm-hmm.
He's now off doing his own thing, amicable split, everyone's happy. But what do you do now, live?
Well, I mean, we've added two new members to the touring bands. You know, kind of what their future in the studio will be determined in time, but... we added a gentleman named Dave Depper, who is from Portland. He's played with Menomina and the Fruit Bats most recently. He was on a touring member of Ray LaMontagne's band. He's been a longtime friend of the band. He's playing guitar, a little bit of keyboard, singing. And then we have a gentleman from Los Angeles named Zach Ray, who is a phenomenal keyboard player and, turns out, a phenomenal guitar player. So,
okay.
You know, as far as the immediate future of the band, kind of going out and playing these songs... you know, adding a fifth person was something that, you know, I'd always wanted to do, and we just were never able to really make it work. But having an extra set of hands has proved invaluable as far as presenting not only these songs, but everything in our back catalog. And outside of, and on top of that, having a third guitar player has just added another level of just, you know, weight and sound to the live experience that, it's just got me really excited. So,
yeah. Is Nick excited about this?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So you don't ever think, hey, how about the bottom end here, you know? Do we really need another
guitar? We already have one of the greatest bass players in rock. We don't need a second one of those.
Honestly, Ben and I keep looking at each other and flash each other looks in the rehearsal space, and I cannot believe how full things sound with, I mean, the addition of a fifth person. I mean, clearly there's just an extra set of hands, but
right.
I mean, two new musical minds has really reinvigorated everything that we're accomplishing right now. So, I just can't wait to get on the road. It feels like I'm right on the edge of a great adventure, and I just can't wait to get started.
There's a song on the album that sounds to me like it might be just the two of you. Is that right? Hold No Guns.
Hold No Guns. It's just Ben and an acoustic guitar. That's it.
Really?
Yeah, just me playing acoustic guitar and recorded live.
Yeah.
As the council's combing through our debris for the treasures we never bury, my
love, why do you run? For my hands hold no guns.
It just goes to show that, you know, the kind of the breadth of the palette, the sonic palette on this record, from you and a guitar, mm-hmm. to the big lush sounds that we get on some of the other tracks and which Death Cab's become known for. Maybe it's too soon to ask this question, but given that Chris was on the record, but did his departure change the songwriting process for you?
No. I've always kind of written in my own little vacuum, and then when I feel I have enough songs, or I also when the other guys kind of chime in and kind of it looks like we're starting to have enough material that we can go into the studio and start making a record, that's typically when we've tended to do that. So my expression as the songwriter has always been the initial expression, and then how those songs are arranged and recorded and presented is something the band has, you know, that's been the band's primary job. Mm. So for me, you know, it's one of those things where, like, this band will never be the same without Chris. But this band has not been the same from album to album. And the constant through all of this is Nick and Jason and, you know, the songs that I've been writing for 17 years.
Right.
So, I say that only to kind of reassure fans that, like, you know, Chris's departure will change the sound of the band. There's no doubt of that. The doubt about that.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I've been the songwriter in this band all these years, and you know, the band can only change so much, you know. The sound can only change so much if I'm still the primary writer, you know.
Is it hard for you as a writer based in the Pacific Northwest to write a song and then give it the title Black Sun? I mean, with that hole in the middle of the title.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I in a park that I run through all the time in Seattle, there's a Noguchi sculpture called the Black Sun, which is, turns out, is also allegedly the inspiration for the Soundgarden song Black Hole Sun, which I did not find out until after we had recorded this song.
Right.
So maybe there's some kind of subconscious Northwest thread tying all these things together. But when I wrote Black Sun, I had kind of thought like that this was purely my invention. Like I was the first one to ever put these words together. God, I'm so brilliant. And then I find out after the fact there's all this occult stuff happening with Black Sun, and there's, you know, the statue in the park I run by every day, and I look at it and go, that's a great looking statue.
When this Black Sun revolved around you, and there is hope within despair, and there is beauty in a failure, and there are depths beyond compare. There is a role of a lifetime, and there's a song yet to be sung. There's a dumpster in the driveway of all the plans that came undone. How could
some, you know, there are certainly songs that we have recorded over the years that, you know, while we're in the studio listening to them back, we would never say anything as gauche as, like, I think we got a hit here.
Yeah,
but there are songs, Black Sun being one of them, that when we're in the studio, it was the first thing we recorded with Rich, and hearing it come back off the speakers, it just sounded so good to us that we were just like, man, people are really going to like this. I mm-hmm. think that people who are fans of the band are really going to dig this song. And
one thing missing from the new album are the epic 8.5 minute long I Will Possess Your Heart type things. I mean, everything here is like, you know, 3 to 5 minutes, it
uh-huh,
seems.
Yeah.
Was that a conscious decision, a producer's decision?
Well, we're just waiting for Nick to bring in another killer bass line. If he can bring in another I'll Possess Your Heart, then we can have another 8.5 minute song.
I'm working on it day and night, day and night. I don't think it was really a conscious decision to not, you know, include songs like that. It really is demo dependent. I mean, yeah. These songs seem to address and come from a place of real specific moments, and there's sort of a brevity in that I think we kind of reflected in the music. I know that, you know, Rich wasn't opposed to anything like that. It just didn't ever really. Sometimes we stumble across a change or there's a moment in a song that absolutely makes sense to, you know, extend mm-hmm. indefinitely.
But they happen really organically. I mean,
very much
like
so, yeah.
I'll Possess Your Heart or Transatlanticism were songs that when we were rehearsing them, we just didn't want to stop playing the progression. It felt so good to continue playing it. And,
right.
you know, while writing songs for this record, there was a song by this band, La Dusseldorf. It was like a German kind of krautrock band. A song called Time that I tried desperately to rip off because I wanted a really long, crowdy kind of song on this record. And I tried and tried and tried to, like, figure out how to kind of steal the essence of that song and make it into a Death Cab song. And it became apparent that unless that happens organically, mm-hmm. we just cannot write long songs to make long songs.
Right,
they have
right.
to just turn out that way, mm-hmm. you know?
When you first brought to the band the song El Dorado, did it have that opening guitar riff?
It did, yes.
And did you guys say, isn't that Don't Fear the Reaper?
Is it Don't Fear the Reaper?
No, it's not actually.
Okay.
But
I mean, it very well could be.
Yeah, so close, though.
You know, that never occurred to us. This is the first time.
Oh my God!
It references. Like,
I gotta go check out Don't Fear the Reaper now.
Definitely.
Kintsugi, the latest album, the 8th full length from Death Cab for Cutie. It's out on March 31st. The guys hit the road in April. You'll be here at Madison Square Garden on September 12th.
Jeez.
Ben, Nick, it's been great having you with us here on Soundcheck today. Thanks so much. Congratulations on the new record.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.